Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a GOP turn on the payroll tax, a dictator dies in North Korea, ominous bombings in Iraq, and a hot American campaign trail. In Washington, John Boehner cried uncle, saying the House GOP would back the Senate's two-month extension to the payroll tax cut.
Why not do the right thing for the American people, even though it's not exactly what we want?
In Iowa, Newt Gingrich slammed Mitt Romney for going negative.
These are his people running his ads, doing his dirty work, while he pretends to be above it.
And in Pyongyang, North Koreans mourn the death of their dear leader, Kim Jong-il. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with CNBC's John Harwood, Gail Shattuck of the Christian Science Monitor, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation, what now for the GOP, for unoccupied Iraq, for North Korea? What's your top story of the week? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. John Harwood joins us from Washington, chief Washington correspondent for CNBC and a political writer for the New York Times. John Harwood, great to have you here.
Hey, Tom.
From Washington as well, Gail Shattuck joins us, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, welcome back to On Point. Wonderful to have you.
Thank you, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point's Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, John, and Gail.
Be gentle on me today, please. I'm just barely, and you might hear it hanging onto my voice. If it goes away, I'll be whistling up here. But it's great to have you all with us. Gail, dive straight in with us. What is it that just happened with the payroll tax cut? It was full-on opposition, or so it seemed, at the beginning, middle of this week, and in the last 24 hours. What has happened, Gail?
I think the incongruity of a party that has staked its brand on not raising taxes out there, you know, conspicuously about to raise taxes on 160 million Americans, in the end was just too much. I mean, it didn't help that the Wall Street Journal editorial page described the whole way the Republicans have handled this as a fiasco. Mm. And it sure didn't help when yesterday Speaker Boehner's main ally on Capitol Hill, the Republican leader Mitch McConnell, in effect told him to just get off, accept the Senate deal, and let's move on. So in the end, the pressure was just too much, and a speaker who has, speaking about brand, staked his reputation on listening to his caucus, went on a 15-minute conference call and said, here's how it's going to be, no questions, goodbye.
This was not a two-way conference call. This was a one-way call.
It was not.
Let's listen to the arc of this week. It was interesting. At the beginning on Monday, House Speaker John Boehner said that the deal worked out in the Senate, a two-month extension. It was nonsense to do things for 2 months, and it was going to be unacceptable to House Republicans.
We opposed the Senate bill because doing a two-month extension instead of a full-year extension causes uncertainty for job creators.
President Obama roared right in on that, standing in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building on just yesterday. President Obama said that what he called obstruction on the payroll tax had gone too far. He was with a group of Americans who said they were outraged that their taxes might go up if a compromise wasn't reached.
So enough is enough. The people standing with me today can't afford any more games. They can't afford to lose $1,000 because of some ridiculous Washington standoff.
That's yesterday, but even on Tuesday, Republican Senator John McCain of Arizona said the infighting over the payroll tax cut extension reflected poorly on his party, the GOP.
It is harming the Republican Party. It is harming the view, if it's possible, anymore of the American people about Congress. And we got to get this thing resolved, and with the realization that the payroll tax cut must remain in effect.
John Harwood, what just happened here this week? They just couldn't stand by appearing to stand in the way of a tax cut? What's the play behind this, John?
The play behind it is that John Boehner wanted the original deal to pass that Mitch McConnell struck with Harry Reid. It drew 89 votes in the Senate.
Yep.
And he was surprised when he got on his conference call with his members and found them rebelling against it. the rebellion made no sense. The objection to the two-month extension was simply a cover story that was concocted to cover the fact that Boehner could not control his caucus. Remember, they had talked about a two-month extension or a month-by-month extension of the debt limit when we had that standoff. Short-term patches are frequently used on Capitol Hill when you can't get to a deal. And, of course, when you have a deal that draws 89 votes, that's as close as consensus as you're going to come to. And what happened was, finally, they were getting pounded so badly for the reasons that Gail mentioned, entirely a self-inflicted wound, that they finally said no mas and pulled the plug and reversed course, got a little fig leaf from Mitch McConnell, who said, well, the Senate needs to agree to appoint negotiators on a longer-term deal, which, of course, he was always willing to do if they passed a two-month extension. And I think Charles Krauthammer, the conservative columnist, said it best in his piece where he said this was a reprise of the scene in Animal House where the marching band turns into a blind alley and a row after row of plumed morons plow into a wall and crumble in a heap on the ground.
Well, okay, but if the Wall Street Journal called it a fiasco, what do you really think? But if they called it a fiasco in the Journal, Charles Krauthammer is calling this one of the worst pieces of legislation in years. He says the passage is a debacle, Jack.
Yes, this has to do with the this idea that somehow it will create uncertainty among job creators and lead to undue paperwork. Speaker Boehner addressed this when he said that there was some kind of fix with the Senate on that. You know, behind this GOP reluctance to do anything to help President Obama, even when they agree, really is political fear. I think Barney Frank, he was exaggerating only slightly when he said that the Tea Party freshmen are either Michelle Bachmann clones or are afraid a Michelle Bachmann clone will primary them if they compromise with the president. And this really reflects the sentiment of a large segment of GOP voters. In one 2010 poll, 67% of Republicans thought Obama was a socialist, 61% that he wants to take away America's guns, 60% thought he was a Muslim, 41% he wants one world government. Just 3 days ago, a poll showed that 52% of likely GOP caucus goers in Iowa believe the president was not born in the United States after all this time. You know, you don't dare compromise with a socialist, Muslim, one-world, Kenyan-born president.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's in that whole context. But, Gail, I mean, I wonder about it on its face. And by the way, it's come through that this morning it's done. It was just a voice vote, Gail. The AP's reporting it's done. It's happened. We're not waiting. There's nobody's going to lay down their Tea Party body on the rails here. It's going through. But is it a good idea? I mean, there's been criticism of this from even from some Democratic quarters, Gail, that not pitching into the Social Security Fund to cover that money is a bad idea. And you've got some Tea Party people who just don't think it makes sense.
Well, I think that that is the most interesting point to come out of all of this. Think for a minute what this deal involves. It's going to cost $120 billion to extend this tax increase and to extend this tax cut, rather. And everyone agrees that we really shouldn't do this year after year. It's just a one-year extension. But when you look at what the president said, look surrounded by people who said, I can't afford to lose $40. With $40, I can buy a snowsuit for my son.
You know,
you can buy
paycheck.
Hot meals.
Yeah.
Exactly. How is that going to be any different a year from now? Are Democrats prepared to go ahead with this? Because what they're doing, you know, on paper, Social Security is made whole. That is, tax Treasury money replenishes the trust fund.
Yeah.
But Treasury money is 40% borrowed on credit. Now, over time, you know, it's going to cost more. You've got to pay interest on it. And the real concern that I think a Democrat who was asleep for the last 5 years and you just brought them out of cold storage and showed them this outcome and said, you know, I'm not going to tell you who's for what, they would be astonished that Democrats would do this because they have strongly resisted anything that undermines this discrete funding stream for Social Security, not at the whim of the budgetary process, not dependent on taxpayer dollars, which are getting very scarce these days, but a fixed, steady, reliable stream. It's that stream that Democrats just cut into.
John Harwood, it was an irresistible political issue from both sides, but what about the economic sense of it? Now, we did hear that if this went away, we might lose a point off of GDP growth next year. That's a lot when the economy, many see, is still potentially at risk of falling backward. But does it make sense to, when you get away from all the politics of it, if that's possible, John?
Well, I guess the question is, makes sense compared to what? Certainly there are shortcomings about doing year to year. There's shortcomings about using the payroll tax as a delivery system for economic stimulus. I think the reason they chose the payroll tax was it gets money into people's hands very quickly. They did agree to methods to raise revenue to pay for the payroll tax cut. So that should not undermine Social Security, although we know that Social Security is going broke in the long run, needs an overhaul, as Medicare does. But this was a product of the deep anxiety that Americans feel about the economy and the need for politicians running in 2012 to appear to be addressing that and alleviate to some degree their economic pressure on them and to stimulate some growth. This has been a very slow recovery. Unemployment's gone down to 8.6% as of the last month's report, but the job market is still very soft. There are some good signs in the economy, and the administration and Republicans don't want to have those let up.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, a GOP reverse on Capitol Hill, Kim Jong-il dead in North Korea, a wave of bombings in the new Iraq. John Harwood joins us with the New York Times and CNBC. Gail Chadwick is here, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, and our own Jack Beatty. Here's John Boehner yesterday pushing back when a reporter asked if he had caved in by agreeing to the two-month payroll tax cut extension.
May not have been politically the smartest thing in the world. But let me tell you what, I think our members waged a good fight. We were able to come to an agreement. We were able to fix what came out of the Senate.
Able to fix what came out of the Senate, but not a very big fix. Gail, can you explain for us on the Keystone XL pipeline element that was here in the Senate and now both versions in the final legislation, I guess? President Obama said he wanted to put that off until I think it was a year from now. Does this require him indeed to make a decision on that big pipeline from the tar sands of Canada down through the Great Plains, sometime early in 2012?
He has 60 days now to make a decision on whether to allow a permit for this pipeline that's been hanging around, I think, since September 2008. This was, I think, the last brilliant stroke of the speaker before it all collapsed. It was a bid to try to convince his members, who just no way wanted to sign on to this thing, that there was a job element in it, that the pipeline would create jobs, and it's a pipeline. So he's touching the whole fossil fuel versus green energy issue. It touched a lot of points. Now, and that did help him get a bill through the House, but and it's now the last bragging point they have. It's the only good thing they can say about this Senate deal. But what happens now is that within 60 days, the president makes a decision on the permit. And if he decides no, a decision that would antagonize unions important to his base that want to see this project go through for what it'll do for jobs, if he says no, he has something like 15 days to present a written account of why it's going to hurt the national interest to the Congress. So really, Republicans are setting up a wedge issue in a short amount of time. Either he approves the project and alarms environmentalists important to his base, or he declines it and alarms the unions. Either way, there's a wedge here for Republicans to play through the 2012 election.
John, how do you read that in terms of Democratic Party politics? It wasn't that many months ago that the Obama administration appeared ready to sign off on this. Then we had people camped out around the White House, and suddenly the president went the other way. Does Obama go yes or no on the pipeline, John?
It would seem to me that he wants to go yes. And those were the signals that we got out of the State Department in recent months until the president decided to defer. I don't know if there is yet another way for him to punt and defer this through 2012, notwithstanding the language in this bill. But it's a difficult issue for the reasons that Gail mentioned. It is a wedge issue. I think the resistance from environmentalists is probably a stronger political force than the backing for this project from unions. But I do think that the president is concerned about jobs, and it would appear that the judgment of the administration before the heat really rose was that the environmental risks of the project were not insuperable.
And so there may be a way, but we'll see. I mean, they put up quite the fuss in the fall. Let's bring our listeners in. Iowa City, Iowa. Bobby's calling. Hi, Bobby. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Yeah.
My view is, why in the world wouldn't the Republican leadership, the Republican people in the House, vote to get rid of Boehner? He's been so divisive. He's so angry. And he won't work with anybody. It's his way or the highway. What we're seeing in Iowa for campaign ads is just beyond the pale.
Bobby, stick with us for a second. Gil Chadwick, what about it? There was talk this week of if this went one way or the other, John Boehner's job might be on the line, but would it be on the line because he's been too divisive or not divisive enough for his Tea Party constituency?
I'm afraid that he would be on the line because he has been not divisive enough. I was standing outside the House Republican caucus Tuesday night as they worked through what they were going to do with the Senate bill. And it sounded like there was a celebration inside. There were war whoops. There were cheers. I mean, it sounded like a pep rally. We learned later that they were kind of riffing off of Braveheart, kind of we're heading into this good fight. Now, this is not John Boehner's style. I mean, he is someone who...
riffing on Braveheart, I can't see the face paint on this guy.
I mean,
we know that there's the one color, the orange, but apart from that...
Well, you know, Dick Gephardt actually went into a Democratic rally once with blue paint on his face. For some reason, this movie resonates in Washington, which I don't understand. If you see it all the way to the end, it's not a happy outcome for anyone who paints their face blue. But Boehner was the one who tried to compromise with the president. Remember when they were talking about a big deal in the run-up to raising the debt ceiling? He actually put $800 billion of revenue on the table, and his base, his rank and file, went nuts. You know, this was a violation of the taxpayer pledge. We can't do this. And he had to back off. And again, with the payroll tax, he was the one that encouraged McConnell to seek a consensus and a deal, which he supported. And when he went on this conference call, he began by saying, "This is a victory for us." And as John points out, the base didn't think so. So his issue isn't that he doesn't fight enough; it's that he's seen as too conciliatory. He is basically a man of the House who wants the House to get back to what it used to do, which is to legislate.
John Harwood, how do you see the speaker hanging on to this bucking bronco he has under him in the Republican side of the aisle?
Well, he's behaved quite cautiously, and you saw him try to react in a nimble fashion when he got the resistance from the caucus on that conference call, and he said, "Oh, I didn't sign off on this deal, and I'm against it, and my caucus is against it." But he really is facing a force and a phenomenon which is unique, and I think other speakers haven't quite had to deal with, which is the Tea Party Republicans in the House of Representatives are simply so angry, so determined to confront the president, that it is difficult for a leader to lead them. They don't respond to the normal political stimuli that we're used to seeing with politicians. One House Republican told me after the standoff that I've never seen a caucus so angry. He said our new members, or the Tea Party members, some veterans as well, are politically brave, but also politically stupid and irrational. And I think that's what John Boehner has had to confront time after time, people who don't believe the warnings that, for example, not raising the debt limit would have a dramatically negative impact on the economy. They think that's just so much Washington hooey. And if people are that alienated from the normal way of doing business politically, it's very hard for a legislator like John Boehner, as Gail said, to get the House back to what it was.
Let's go to Carl in Oakland, Iowa. Carl, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking the call, Tom. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Here's what I think, getting back to the lead-in issue. The business about borrowing Chinese money to replace the money that Social Security is going to lose so that people will have an extra $40 to buy Chinese-made goods is the ultimate insanity of the American people. We need to go back and look at how this country had at one time become an economic powerhouse, and that was Americans consumed American products.
So, Carl, would you say no to the payroll tax cut? Would you stand with the Tea Party caucus in the House then, Carl?
No, I would call this nation collectively stupid. We need to sit back and look at how we became the powerhouse, and the president, if he is in fact the president of the people, should be out there hammering the point day after day after day that this country needs to produce American goods, and that Americans, to show their loyalty to their country and to look out for their neighbor, must consume American-produced goods, not Chinese-made electronics assembled.
Yeah, we got it, Carl. There's certainly,
by the Chinese
certainly
Army.
Been a push for manufacturing, more manufacturing here, but the bigger push this week, just get this payroll tax cut, and you may be right about how the money rolls. Debbie in Billerica, Massachusetts. Debbie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Frankly, I was rather appalled at the treatment you just did for the tar sands KXL pipeline, because this is a very big issue, both environmentally and with regard to climate change.
Absolutely, and we've given it a lot of attention right here. But what's your concern today, Debbie?
My concern today was the fact that this whole thing as a jobs issue is really quite bogus. The numbers that the oil companies are giving out were from a report that was done for the oil companies. The Cornell Engineering School report has job growth at about, I think, I don't have the numbers at the top of my head, but it was somewhere around, I think, 2,000 to maybe 3,500 jobs.
And not the tens of thousands.
The State Department report was, you know, in the area of, I think, 6,000 to 8,500. I wish I had the numbers. And when you just sort of throw that in as a jobs issue, you're really misinforming the American people about an important issue.
Well, the details will come out in due time, but you know very well. I mean, I think my guest's angle here was that is how it will be represented. How do you see it, Debbie? Do you think the president would stand up in this 60-day period at the end of it and say no to this, or do you think he'll say yes to the pipeline?
I have no idea, but the thing is, when you just sort of fall in with the Republican numbers like this is a jobs issue, you're misinforming the public.
Point taken, but we have informed in great depth on more than one occasion right here. Jack?
Yeah, Tom, it's not only a jobs issue. In the last debate, Newt Gingrich really, I think, put his finger on a political liability in this for the president. He was pointing out Iran. He said, suppose Iran blockades the Straits of Hormuz. Meanwhile, we're stopping a pipeline that could bring oil from Canada to our country. This, he said, is insane. The point is, this has got strategic international implications, too, I think, that make it just deadly for the president to side with the environmentalists.
But Debbie's point, well taken, that when you hear the arguments made, look carefully at the claims that are made about jobs and so on. There will be claims flying all over the place. And yes, as we discussed here on the show earlier, a lot of the study behind this funded by the oil companies themselves with obviously an interest in this. Speaking of Newt Gingrich, he was very unhappy this week with kind of attack ads that had been moving in Iowa and seemed to have dented his standing in the polls there, coming out very tough on a number of fronts, among them saying you've got to go after activist judges, even maybe sending out marshals to bring in judges. Here's an exchange between Bob Schieffer on CBS's Face the Nation and Newt Gingrich on Sunday. Schieffer first.
One of the things you say is that if you don't like what a court has done, that Congress should subpoena the judge and bring him before Congress and hold a congressional hearing. Some people say that's unconstitutional, but I'll let that go for a minute. I just want to ask you from a practical standpoint, how would you enforce that? Would you send the Capitol Police down to arrest him?
If you had to. Or you'd instruct the Justice Department to send the U.S. Marshal.
John Harwood, here's Newt Gingrich. He's always got something, that gets your attention up his sleeve. Could you see a president, Newt Gingrich, sending out marshals to arrest and bring in American judges, John? What's he angling for here?
He's angling for votes in the Republican caucus. This is crazy talk that would never be implemented. I think Newt Gingrich is somebody who uses bombastic rhetoric for purpose, and the purpose is getting attention. He's been trying to run a campaign in the Republican caucuses in which he doesn't attack fellow Republicans. We saw this in debates, and we've seen it on the stump. He goes after the media. He goes after judges. These are familiar targets for him and ones that are unifying within the Republican Party, and that's what this is all about. It's not a serious proposal.
There was an effort to have the wives out front as we approach the holidays here, a little softer tone, but even in the softer tone, some digs this week in Iowa. You can hear Callista Gingrich and then Anita Perry and Ann Romney. Ann Romney asking about if you want to know how a person will operate, look at how they've lived their life.
Is there anything more inspiring than American towns and neighborhoods brightly lit for the holidays?
It's an old-fashioned American story. I married my high school sweetheart, but first I had to wait as he volunteered for the Air Force and flew planes all over the world.
And if you really want to know how a person will operate, look at how they've lived their life.
It's all American beauty, but look at how they live their life, and much tougher than that, in Romney commercials. And then Newt was in the Capitol building in Des Moines on Wednesday and ran into Occupy Des Moines, heckling here for Gingrich. And later, hecklers reportedly chased him and his wife Callista from the building. That's not nice. Here's audio from CNN.
Let me say, first of all,
Mike Schaff! Mike Schaff! Press conference!
Will you put him?
Jack Beatty, what do you think about the tenor of the Iowa campaign at this point? We've got all the, you know, creamy, peachy wives there, their own digs, but then Mike Check and he's the 1%.
He's the 1%. 1,200 anti-Gingrich messages in the last week on TV, according to one analyst. He's being massively outspent there. And, of course, this is to do with the super PACs, which were created last year after that Supreme Court decision that allowed them. The sheer amount is expected to reach record levels, both in the primary and just a rehearsal for the general election, because this money comes directly from corporations, unions, and so on, and it doesn't have to, and there's no limit to it. So we're going to see lots more of this. And I think perhaps the worst ad for Mr. Gingrich was a Romney piece being mailed to people that says Barack Obama's Christmas list, and it has only one wish on it: Newt Gingrich as the Republican nominee for 2012. Please, Santa, it says.
John Harwood, do you see Newt Gingrich cresting this week in Iowa? Do you have a sense from the polls that they'll change and they'll change again, but is he still on a roll or not now?
No, he's not on a roll now. He's taken a lot of fire. He's, to some degree, reaping the consequences of not having constructed a broad and deep campaign and campaign infrastructure. He rose on momentum, strong debate performances. And he still has significant assets in the race and credibility with conservatives that Mitt Romney doesn't have. But under very strong attack from the Mitt Romney super PAC, from Romney himself, facing scrutiny from the news media, he's losing some altitude. And the question is, does he lose enough that Iowa ends up crippling him so that he does not find himself able to compete in New Hampshire and sustain the lead that he has built in South Carolina and Florida, which are two states following New Hampshire?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, after a third tour in Iraq, Army pilot Chris Sigger, along with a lot of other servicemen and women, truly came home for the holidays.
Are you staying?
I'm done, honey.
Oh, my God!
Rough weather for holiday travelers in the Great Plains. Here's one among thousands stranded.
I slid off in the median, was there for several hours waiting for help, and took me 3 hours to get 30 miles.
And a funeral today in Prague for the great Czech artist, leader, champion of freedom, and Frank Zappa, Václav Havel.
At St. Vitus Cathedral, they draped the coffin and the flag of the country he led out of communism. The democratic world came to pay tribute.
Václav Havel. John Harwood joins us, CNBC New York Times with us today from Washington. Gail Chadwick of the Christian Science Monitor here, and Jack Beatty joins us. You can join us as well. Let's go to Kevin in Randolph, Massachusetts. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
On the issue with Iraq and the events of the last few days, we all remember the justifications the Bush administration put forward a decade ago for going to war with Iraq, all of which have since been disproven, the connection to Al-Qaeda, bin Laden, connection to 9/11, and, of course, WMD. But when they were putting forth these arguments, they always, at the end of all these arguments, almost as an aside, they made the statement, and besides, we're going to create a wonderful beacon of democracy in the Middle East that the rest of the Middle Eastern countries will emulate. Well, I think the last nail has been put in that coffin now. A lot of us knew that was pretty much hogwash. I don't think anyone really believed that Iraq was ever going to be that shining beacon of democracy, and I think that events of the last few days have borne that out.
Well, I don't know if we're all the way there yet, Kevin, but it's certainly troubling. And if you would let us look at what's been going on. I mean, this wave of bombing just days after the U.S. left Iraq, the vast majority of the troops, bombings that had the kind of look of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, that is Sunni on Shiite bombings. These coming after the Iraqi leader Maliki had made some pretty tough moves against his opposition there, seemed to walk away from the shared government structure the U.S. had been supporting. Big pushback. He put out an arrest warrant for Iraq's vice president, Tariq al-Hashimi. And al-Hashimi ends up in Kurdistan, the Kurdish-dominated north part of Iraq. Here he is saying why he doesn't want to be back within Maliki's grasp.
There is no transparency, and the system is affected by corruption. Iraq's justice system is in crisis. It has lost its credibility. It's a tool in the hands of some politicians. Therefore, it's not realistic for me to stand trial in front of the system. I reiterate what I said before. I'm more than happy to face justice in Kurdistan, where I can be treated justly.
Jack Beatty, here we are, just days out of Iraq, and all these tensions boiling to the surface, not least with bombs attached.
Not least, and an Arab paper, Al Hayat, is reporting that, quoting a security official in the Iraq government, that armed groups are reemerging all over Sunni Iraq, and they're talking about ammunition coming in. They're talking about supplies, and of course there is that 100,000 core of the awakening. You know, the Iraqi Shiite, the Sunni awakening. These people are armed. The Maliki government has ignored them. They're not paying their salaries. They're not employing them as police as they promised to do, leaving them restive, armed, and dangerous. And you know, to the point that Kevin was making about the mess that we have left there, this Mr. Hashimi addressed that just that. Speaking to Foreign Policy, he said, "What missions have you fulfilled? Have you turned Iraq to become a democratic symbol? Have you turned Iraq from an autocratic regime to a democratic regime? This has not happened."
Here's more on that line from opposition leader Ayad Alawi talking to the Associated Press in an interview in Beirut, saying violence is going to go on as long as the government in Baghdad excludes powerful groups in Iraq.
"We have warned long ago that terrorism will continue to be acting in Iraq against the Iraqi people unless the political landscape is corrected and the political process is corrected and it becomes an inclusive political process."
John Harwood, it's difficult to look over this far over the horizon, but here's Iraq just days after we saw the last U.S. troops rumble out with all this trouble. And it will obviously be clearly watched during the election year in this country ahead. Do you see Iraq staying sturdy enough that it doesn't become a liability? And if it does, who's it a liability for?
Well, I think one of the tests of the Obama administration will be if, in fact, conditions deteriorate in a substantial way that's visible and concerning to the American public and to policymakers. What will the response be? Will it be to reinsert the United States in some fashion to resolve it, or will our relations be, with Iraq, as administration officials have said, just be like those with any other normal country. And it's also a test for the Republican candidates. What sort of commitments will they make if they see Iraq dissolving or deteriorating? Is Mitt Romney, if he should win the Republican nomination, is he going to stake his campaign in part on committing to do something about it over there? Or, in fact, will the war weariness of the American public prove so strong that he's not willing to do that? I would bet on the latter, but it will be interesting to watch.
Mitt Romney this week in Keene, New Hampshire, is saying that if we knew then what we know now, we shouldn't have gone in. And then people pointing fingers again on the Romney flip-flop front, saying, wait a minute, look back in January 2008, when we basically knew everything that we know now, Mitt Romney showing strong support for the invasion of the Iraq and the waging of that war, even though it was clear by that point that Iraq did not possess weapons of mass destruction. Here's Romney in 2008.
It was the right decision to go into Iraq. I supported it at the time. I support it now.
And here he is in Keene, New Hampshire with NBC's Chuck Todd on Thursday.
If we knew at the time of our entry into Iraq that there were no weapons of mass destruction, if somehow we had been given that information, why obviously we would not have gone in. But to go back and say, well, knowing what we know now, would we have gone in? Well, knowing what we know now, they did not have weapons of mass destruction. There would have been no effort on the part of our president or others to take military action.
Gail, you're there among lots of Republicans and Democrats on Capitol Hill. How do you see Iraq playing out in the year ahead as the Americans look to the polls and Iraq looks to its own future?
You know, one issue that I've thought a lot about in the last few weeks is how difficult it is to make a case to the American people that's longer than a few sentences. And even if there is a powerful argument to be made, if you cannot do it concisely, no one is going to get it. And that's, I think, a real issue with how you look at the Iraq war. John McCain took to the floor on the day that U.S. troops were pulled out of Iraq and gave, you know, a series of very powerful speeches, in effect saying, this president is wasting 10 years of American blood and treasure. You know, he's pulling out prematurely, and he's to blame for this. Mm. Well, to answer that argument is going to take more than a few sentences. It's typical to blame the guy who makes the decision at the time it's made, regardless. And anyone who opposes it is going to have trouble not looking like they're attacking the sacrifice of the troops or diminishing what they achieved. It's going to be a very difficult issue. I don't see that it doesn't play in 2012, depending on who the Republican nominee is.
Fascinating chemistry coming on that front as Iraq's future, and heaven help them, but as it plays out in real time. Trevor in Cedar Falls, Iowa. Trevor, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm in Iowa listening to the conversation now, and I think it's really frustrating to see us coming out of Iraq, all the failed goals there, and seeing only one candidate willing to talk about a strategy other than bombing other countries, and that's Ron Paul, and he's getting laughed off the stage. And, you know, I'm no Ron Paul supporter by any stretch of the imagination, but, you know, I'm waiting for
Trevor, we're losing you. You say laughed off the stage, and yet I think he's looking a little stronger again in polls this week. Here's Ron Paul, this is on Tuesday, talking to CNN's John King about why his libertarian message might be resonating.
I think they see me as a challenge for the status quo. You know, there's a lot of people I challenge, you know, everybody from the military-industrial complex to the banking system, to the bailouts, to our foreign policy. It's a big deal because I want changes. But that's what the American people want. The American people are with me, and that's why I believe I'm going up in the polls.
Jack Beatty, you've been watching those polls as we barrel toward Iowa's caucuses and the New Hampshire primary. How do you see the Ron Paul card playing in here, Jack? Up, down, and for whom?
Well, he's up now, barely, in Iowa, and he's second, about 19 to Romney's 35 in New Hampshire. But he's also now facing, as a front runner, renewed and intense media scrutiny. He walked out of a interview with CNN yesterday when the interviewer raised the question of the racist newsletters he put out under his name in the 1990s, which, I mean, I've seen some of the things written in them, and they were vile. I mean, one was sort of instructions on how to shoot young black people if they come up to your car. You know, really vile stuff. He said he didn't write it. He didn't know anything about it. He didn't read it. Well, he took a different line on this in the 90s in Texas, where he did not deny having to do with these things. So whether this flap is going to bring him down, as it has, as similar flaps have, you know, created problems for the other candidates, remains to be seen.
But John Harwood, Ron Paul, so far it's been on the up. He shunts those things to the side. Who does he hurt if he hurts? And what if he wins somewhere, John? Where does it go? Does he roll on?
No, he doesn't roll on. Ron Paul has got a high floor and a low ceiling. He represents very consistently the libertarian wing of the Republican Party. They like him for the purity of his vision on libertarian ideas and small government ideas. The rest of the Republican Party obviously does not go along with his views on foreign policy and non-intervention in international conflicts. So Ron Paul is sort of a quirk of our system, somebody who represents a well-defined set of voters, but not one that is expandable, certainly not with some of that kooky stuff that Jack was talking about in his background.
Let's go to Paul in Bedford, New Hampshire. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, Ron Paul, I give him credit for being true to his convictions. I think the policy direction, his words would suggest that he would leave would be a non-starter. And I'm really dismayed when I hear Jack talk about what, you know, surveys say Republican voters believe, which brings me to my real question. With the recent endorsements here in New Hampshire, does the only apparent sensible centrist candidate in that field, John Huntsman, does he have a shot? How can he get in this race and make a difference?
Paul, thanks for your call. Jack, you're in New Hampshire. You've been out. You've seen a little Mitt Romney on the hustings this week. What about John Huntsman? He has picked up some endorsements. They're sensible centrists, says Paul.
Yes, the Concord Monitor gave him a very good endorsement yesterday or the day before. He's running ads here. He's made well over 100 town meetings, and you see signs, even signs in not just on the highways but in people's yards, which is one of the metrics up here. So he seems to be doing. He's in double digits in the polls. So, and he's got one of these super PACs working for him, one, you know, essentially built around his father. So he might well chip away at Romney here. Whether he can win, I doubt it. There probably isn't the time. But that Concord Monitor endorsement helps.
And from abroad, this from North Korea this week, the announcer, broadcaster, after the announcing the death of Kim Jong-il.
너무도 갑자기. 너무도 애석하게 우리 곁을.
Gail, the whole world's attention grabbed there by the emotional displays, and of course, right behind that, the nuclear weapons and the uncertainty about this very reclusive country. What's the talk in Washington of some change here, or just watch and wonder what happens?
You know, in another year, we would have started talking about this issue and not talked about anything else. It just seems that the prospect of nuclear weapons seems so remote in our current world. We're worried about everything but that. But when I was a kid, I mean, this was an obsession. You know, who has nuclear weapons? What's going to happen? And the idea, you know, this is a government unlike any other. You know, there's a deification of leadership at a time where, you know, every other country is tearing down their leaders as fast as they can. I mean, there is a whole infrastructure here that just builds it up. There was a very interesting piece in the Wall Street Journal this morning about the propaganda machine back of the new leader, you know, a four-star general who's never served in the military, referencing, you know, stories of his, I think, grandfather, destroying an American tank with a pine cone. You know, it is a different. He turned a pine cone into a grenade, and that's how he destroyed the tank.
I mean, water into wine.
Yeah, I mean, talk about a place where you really need to focus on trying to understand And that really does take more than a few sentences.
Well,
all the things we've talked about, this really deserves a lot of attention. It's not getting it.
Well, we've given it a full hour this week and more. But as you say, Gail and John, Jack, everything we talk about today, all roads, despite everything going on in the world these days, Americans' attention, their concerns lead back home to this country, this economy, this society. We're thinking of that especially right here in the midst of the holidays. I want to thank all three of you for being with us today. John Harwood with CNBC and the New York Times. Thank you so much for being with us, John.
Happy holidays, Tom.
Same to you, sir. Gail Chadwick, wonderful to have you with the Christian Science Monitor. Thank you so much for joining us today, Gail.
Thank you, Tom.
And Jack Beatty, have a wonderful holiday. Merry Christmas, Jack. Thanks so much for being here.
To you and to all our listeners.
And a final note from the world of arts. On Point keeps popping up. Radiohead sampled the show on the Colbert Report in September. Now mashup artist Titus Jones has us right in the opening bars of his new album, Culture Shock. Here it is, right at the top, along with Nicki Minaj, Christina Aguilera, Jay-Z, Beyonce, our crew. You can hear the full track at onpointradio.org. Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, peace and joy. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. Good, loving holidays to all. This is On Point.
We are living in a mashed-up musical world right now.
A mashup is when you take two or more songs and combine them.
Don't worry about me and who I fire. I get what I desire. It's my empire. And yes, I call a shot. I am the umpire. I sprinkle whole water upon the vampire.
Shock me with that deviant behavior.